Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you very much for joining us as we take a look at an uplifting collection of spiritually illuminating texts and powerfully thought-provoking real-life stories showing death as an integral part of life. My guest is the author of Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. Her name is Anna Marie Hemingway, and she is a writer, spiritual counselor, and member of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. As we continue our series on transitioning here on Tell Me Your Story.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And trying to understand the process of transitioning is not easy because we don't really have a great number of points of reference. Well, Anna Marie Hemingway is going to help to give us some points of reference. And Anna, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you in studio. It's always nice to have someone face-to-face to talk with.
Face-to-face, yes. And glad to be with you.
And you've written this book called, again, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, as opposed to, I guess, what, unconscious? I mean, does that kind of go without saying?
It does, but I think that the term, you know, when people ask what does practicing conscious living and dying actually mean, it means living your life with death being a reality rather than something that's just blocked off and becomes unconscious.
Blocked off, or in some cases they've blocked it off because they're afraid of it.
Yeah, fear is a great barrier to understanding, you know, what death actually means and can teach us in life.
And your book is a collection of stories of people who have experienced, I guess we want to define what it is that they've experienced, because obviously if you've interviewed them and you've written their story, they came back to life. So these would be the near-death experiences. How are you able to, when you put these stories together, put together a composite of what death is like?
Well, I guess there's a mystery involved in death, and I'm certainly not trying to say that, you know, we can solve it, but what we do get from people who've had a near-death experience is perhaps a glimpse of certainly what might happen at that moment when we're clinically dead. These people actually feel their consciousness actually move out of the body, and will often describe similar events that make it very possible that that's indeed what is happening to them.
Okay. We're going to talk more about that as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. If you'd like to chime in, we'd love to hear from you. 564-1290, 564-1290. If you're listening streaming on the Internet, we certainly hope that you take that opportunity. At richarddugan.com, the number is 866-564-1290. That's 866-564-1290. And we will take your calls live here on the program, here on this beautiful, beautiful June Saturday afternoon, the last one of 2008. Tell me your story about your near-death experience. I honestly cannot say I've had one, or at least I can't say that I've had one that I'm aware of. Does that happen very often, Anna Marie Hemingway, author of Practicing Conscious Living and Dying? Do people have these experiences and sometimes they're not even aware that they have them? They think they're a dream?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean there, whether you mean they've had one but they're not sure whether it's a dream, or whether they might have had one and not even recollected it at all.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, it was a near-death experience, but to them, it seemed like one of their ordinary dreams.
I don't think that's possible.
Okay.
Because if you've had a near-death experience, it certainly is not like an ordinary dream. I mean, these experiences are so vivid, and they retain that initial imagery for the rest of the person's life. So I'm certainly sure you'd know if you had one.
So there is a profundity to these experiences that you are not soon to forget.
I don't think you forget it at all. I mean, to start off with, normally these experiences are caused by some kind of trauma to the body, like an accident or a heart attack. So certainly you would know at the time that something tremendous was happening, but it seems at that very point that the person's essence or soul actually does move out of the body. And the near-death experience has many components. Not everyone will have exactly the same sequence of events, but certainly they all talk about moving through a tunnel or a dark void into the light. Sometimes they're met by deceased relatives or friends or just a being or some kind of religious entity. They often have a life review in mm-hmm. which they get the chance to actually look at their lives. And although there's no judgment, often these people are their own harshest critics because they look at their life. And like one of the people in one of the stories I did actually said, you know, I realized I just wanted to come back and make a slightly better movie.
Mm-hmm.
So
I like that.
I think there is almost like a shedding of this idea that we're just our ego-based self. It's almost like that gets left behind, and a purer source of ourselves is actually what returns after such an experience. Because certainly these people are very different.
Mm-hmm.
They live very different lives, and when you talk to them, you can sense the fact that they're very different. They often work in service-orientated jobs or work with the dying or something similar like that. And so I think the lessons they bring back aren't just about death and what death might be like, but also perhaps a better way to actually live life.
How do these experiences, these near-death experiences, aside from what you've already described, differ from what are called out-of-body experiences?
Well, out-of-body experiences can take place, and they do have similar components, but I think the thing is a near-death experience actually does have the certain components that I mentioned earlier, and so can be very different because it's the magnitude of what takes place, and often the people are told that they have to go back to their body, that they have a job to do. Out-of-body experiences, I think many people have the sensation, sometimes through meditation or other ways, of actually, you know, feeling themselves out of that body space, but it's not quite the same experience.
How did you connect with the people that you wrote about in your book?
Well, I guess I decided to write the book because I felt the need to write something that was what I hope is a source book for people to come to terms with death and dying, not only from the curiosity point of view of what might happen to us when we do die, but also in how to deal with death when it does come into our lives, which it inevitably will. And so the stories, I think it's like anything else. Once you've decided to do something, you even feel that that's what you're meant to be doing, the stories sort of just appeared by themselves, very synchronistically. Somebody would tell me about someone they thought I should get in contact with, or I met people myself and started to talk to them and ask them, and, you know, they were very happy to actually contribute. And that's what I found all the way through. And I was very privileged, really, to be able to write the stories of some incredible people.
Now, you have given us the explanation as to, in essence, why you wrote the put this together and how you brought these people together. But why did you, Anna Marie Hemingway, decide that this was such an important topic from your perspective?
From my perspective, I've done a lot of work in conscious dying from the Eastern philosophy, because I find Western society is the one big thing that we have absolutely no education about. And I realized as I was going through the dying process with my mother, which had, you know, many painful parts to it, that there was another side of death that actually was quite beautiful in a way. It allows us to be our most authentic selves. It strips away everything that's unimportant. And sometimes we're, you know, honored to have grace entering into our lives. And I became privy to sharing, you know, an incredible experience. And during that time, I also realized how, because the rest of my family or people, friends, relatives, had not perhaps had, you know, the background that I did, that they came from a very different perspective, and it was all really very difficult and painful for them. And so I think it was those two things coupled together. I actually felt that my mother's life was and did culminate in the birth of this book. So that was one thing I felt very strongly, that I was really very motivated, you know, from perhaps an outside source. or maybe a higher source, I should say. And the second reason really is because I think that we actually need more guidance. We need more sources to look back to when we actually have to confront the end of life with someone. And, you know, we take other journeys on our lives and we usually get maps and make preparations and plan the journey. Mm-hmm. And with death, we don't. And yet it's the most important journey that we will take during this lifetime.
Why do you think that is?
That we don't make arrangements?
No. Why do you think it is that it's the most important journey?
Because I think, you know, life starts at birth and it ends with death. And in between, we sort of have jammed what is our particular lifetime. But most people are actually so afraid of death that it acts as a barrier to them, you know, perhaps enjoying life to the maximum. So I think if we can free ourselves from all or some of that anxiety, which, again, stories of near-death experience, and in my book I mentioned deathbed visions and a number of other phenomena that are associated during the dying process, such as after-death communication as well. I think that all of these things show us that actually death is a journey, it's a transition, and it is very important because it is really the culmination of our lifetime. Many people say, you know, you die as you have lived. And so if we want a good death or if we want a good life, we really have to hold those two places, that we walk with the shadow of death and yet we live life.
Of the people that you have compiled the stories of in your book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, do you know how many of them are still alive today?
I think they're all alive.
They're all still alive. So they just had the near-death experience at this particular point in their lives. And what about the age ranges? Were most of these people involved in traumatic experiences that propelled them into those near-death experiences?
Well, the first section of my book actually deals with near-death experiences. And, yes, most of them were. One lady was electrocuted in a storm. Another man had a very serious heart attack. I actually have the story of Larry Hagman in my book, who people might remember as J.R. Ewing, because mm-hmm. he actually lives in my hometown.
As well as Major Nelson from I Dream of Jeannie.
Exactly. And I think his story is very interesting. He was very seriously ill himself with his second experience when he had his liver transplant. But when you talk about, you know, the different people and what kind of lives they have, I think Larry's story is really interesting because for most people he would, you know, he would be thought of to have achieved everything in life that we want, success, money, wealth, power. But his nagging realization that there was something more and he couldn't actually get a handle on it made him go into a depression. And it was through this depression that he realized that he had an inner quest to actually find out a deeper meaning of life. And it was his own two near-death-like experiences that actually gave him the answer that he was looking for. And he came back, as many of these other experiences do, you know, emphatic that there was no reason to be afraid of death, that death was not the end, that we do continue, and that love is the most important thing to share, which I think we could all, you know, be reminded of, especially right now in the present situation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But also, he started doing what all these other people do, you know, working for charities and raising money, becoming very actively involved. And so we see that these people, again, they do choose a different kind of life to live. The people were, I guess, varying ages, you know, perhaps from maybe 70-ish to somebody who was really quite young at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it matters, you know, really, what age you are, what religious conviction you might or might not have. None of these things actually seem to figure really whether you have a near-death experience or whether you don't.
Did these experiences propel them into a more spiritual life? Did people even have maybe this was such a life-altering event that it turned their lives around from maybe being, I don't know, a ruffian, a gangster, you know, a bully at school, or just not living their lives really well, and it just kind of turned them around?
I think it did turn them around. All of the people that I interviewed are living very different lives now. My first story, that of Reuben Beckham, who actually happens to be a friend of mine, you know, he worked in the banking and real estate world. He was a workaholic. He had two failed marriages. And following his experience, he knew that he had something to do and wasn't quite sure what it was. But it turned out that it was to be a spiritual counselor to the dying. And, you know, this is a man that had a heart attack, was told if he didn't have surgery within 3 months he'd be dead, was given drugs and things in the meantime, threw the drugs away, has had no surgery, works round the clock now, is 70 or thereabouts, with no medical intervention. 50 clients sometimes at a time, driving 300 miles a day, working from 6 in the morning till 12 at night. Now, how is he doing that? Well, something very extraordinary happened to him on all sorts of levels. And I think, you know, for me, one of the great things about the near-death experience and the other things I've written about is that it shows us that, you know, things are not like we just assume them to be. Anything can happen at any moment, and miracles can happen too. So I think it, you know, widens our appreciation of not only what consciousness is and what our part in that is, but also that, you know, things are orchestrated sometimes from perhaps a different source, and that we don't have control, total control over our own lives.
The interesting thing is, in your book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, the last story in the book is yours.
It is.
And you had this experience that if what you've shared with us up to this point is true, altered your life.
Yes, but mine wasn't actually a near-death experience. It's only the first section of my book that is near-death experiences. There are a lot of other phenomena around the dying process, and I guess my story was really the culmination of the book, which was the story of my journey with my mother and why I wrote this book. And in that story, I actually talk about experiencing deathbed visions with her, which actually share a lot of similar components to a near-death experience, when a dying person is actually visited by deceased family, friends, maybe a pet, or a religious entity, an angel, depending on your own, you know, spiritual orientation, that come to tell the dying person that they're actually going to be accompanied on this journey, that they won't be alone, and sometimes they actually get glimpses of what, you know, an afterlife could look like. So I don't differentiate between any of these phenomena. I think that they're all, in a sense, penetrating that veil and seeing, you know, through to something else that is going on. And I think the interesting thing, again, about deathbed visions is that, like near-death experiences, we try and have all kinds of scientific and medical explanations, and right now we don't have a complete answer. But it's not just the dying person very often that will see these end-of-life visions. You know, many hospice workers see them. Many people that are with a dying person will see them. So I think that gives us food for thought, you know.
Well, and at the time of this program, because this will be available up on our website and you'll be able to listen to the archive, we experienced the passing of a comedian here in the States, George Carlin. And if anyone knows the comedy of George Carlin, and as you said, sometimes we will experience in those near-death experiences what we believe, the religious experiences that we've had, the figures and so on and so forth. And so the comment was actually made by my wife, because I was curious as to what his experience must be like. She says, well, he probably got the box of all the lost stuff through his lifetime, which was a premise of one of his jokes, that where does all that lost stuff go? And he probably got that when he got to where he was going, because that was maybe one of his experiences. I'm curious also as to, are you, I mean, we talked a little bit about out-of-body experiences versus near-death experiences. Did you do any interviewing with people who had out-of-body experiences, or you really did you screen people to make sure that you were dealing with near-death versus out-of-body?
Well, I think near-death experience is very easy to tell a near-death experience, okay, simply because, you know, in the initially, Dr. Raymond Moody, who compiled the first book on the NDE, was closely followed by Dr. Kenneth Ring, and he actually did a scientific study in which he measured, or rather detailed, the amount of people he'd interviewed, the certain things that happened in a near-death experience. And so I think it's very easy to tell when it's a near-death experience. But
so you didn't have any problems determining who was having what, and so you moved forward in that regard.
No.
And were those fairly comfortable interviews that you conducted? I mean, because that's, again, that whole process, as you've shared with us up to this point, having them relive, because you would have to go back and relive how they got to that state in the first place with all of that trauma. How was that?
Well, actually, for most people, very interestingly, another thing that they tend to do with their lives is that they feel that they really need to spread the word about what has happened. So most people I spoke to, well, all of the people I spoke to, are very comfortable talking about their experiences and want to share them because they think there's a valuable lesson for other people. And I think that's been proven to be true, that near-death experience narratives do help other people change their own attitudes, whether they've had a near-death experience themselves or not.
And that's what we're here to do also, is share the stories of folks who are having experiences, new paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And if you can get through the process of understanding the as some would say, the inevitability of death. There are others who disagree and say it's not inevitable, but we're going to take it as a point of not arguing about it. And we'll continue talking more here on Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned. Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan with Anna Marie Hemingway. If you'd like to get a copy of her book, we certainly encourage you to do so, to check out the stories in Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. .com. That is the website, practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com. You can also get there via annamariehemingway.com or go to richarddugan.com, click on the link on the programs page, the radio shows page. Page 3, we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking with the author of Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Anna Marie Hemingway, as we take your calls at 564-1290. If you're listening on the Internet, give us a call at 866-564-1290. This is Tell Me Your Story, new paradigms for a new world, bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices so that you can go out and fulfill your dreams. Take control of your life and live your purpose. And I think that maybe, Anna Marie, that's part of what you're trying. You're helping people as well. If they can get a handle on this experience, then they're able to kind of. It's like you said before. We plan all our trips, right? Get the maps out, and we say, okay, we're going to go here, and we're going to go there, and so forth. And then we get the luggage together, and we get all the supplies together. Well, of course, with death, there's no supplies to get together per se, but other than in our own minds. So if you can kind of get all of that set aside, saying, okay, I'm ready, anytime, and then they can go off and live their life. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so, because I think, managing to get over this fear of death actually opens things up for people, because it's not a limitation. And that the truth is that most of us, without thinking that death might be a part of our life at some point, you know, we don't always maximize our lives. And I often think that, you know, it's sad if a person gets to the end of their life and then it's been an unlived life and they're wishing that they'd done things differently or been different or worked differently or followed their passion but didn't. And so I think that it's very valuable, certainly in these stories. We often see that these people are actually doing what they were meant to do, using their talents, using their abilities, often helping other people, but enjoying life a lot more.
Yeah. Well, comedy's a part of that, and I can't help but be reminded of Bob Newhart and his little interaction with Suzanne Plachet on the Bob Newhart Show, where he's dealing with death throughout the entire episode, and they're laying there in bed, and he's just going on and on about this. And she says, well, Bob, why are you worried about it? Death is just another, it's just a part of life. To which Bob responds, yeah, the last part, which isn't necessarily true in as much as what we've been able to discover thus far, that it's the dying part that we probably are more afraid of than what's on the other side. It's going through that passageway, if you will, that transition is what we're most concerned about and scared about. And speaking of which, a question was brought up during the break. Did any of the people that you interviewed, number one, did they struggle with it as it was happening, fight it, I don't want to go here? And once they were there, did some of them not want to come back, but that they were just constantly being bombarded by the message from whomever, whatever, they weren't finished with their work here?
I think some people, when they actually go through the initial dark tunnel, may call out, you know, what's happening here, what's going on. But it seems that as soon as they get into the light, or they're shown, you know, other beings may come along or something, that immediately disappears. But perhaps there is some initial resistance from people. About coming back, I think most of these people definitely don't want to come back. They feel that, you know, they've experienced unconditional life, many for the first time in their lives. And that feels so overwhelming and wonderful that they actually don't want to return. Some, you know, beg not to come back, but many are told that they have a specific job or some work to complete during this earthly existence, and that they will be shown or they will find out what that is. Certainly during a near-death experience, it almost seems like a part of the person's false sense of self has, you know, been shed, almost like a snake skin, because often they actually come back and they have abilities they didn't have before, like healing abilities or telepathic or something of that nature, and use these new gifts in their future work. So many of them also, actually, when they do return into the physical body, have a hard time integrating the experience and, you know, oscillate between remembering what it was like and you know, being back in that body and having to live this life. From my research, most of these people now are quite happy to be here because they feel they have something to do, but at the same time they're quite looking forward to, you know, that day when they can go back. And, you know, Jung himself, I'm sure most people will be acquainted with C.G. Jung. He had a near-death experience, and all of these things were very similar for him, and he described it as being, you know, something out of time, space, and logic that, in a way, words can't really articulate. But even for him, after this experience, the work that he carried on doing from then on until his own eventual actual real death took on a fresh perspective. So, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be very different from the space astronauts that actually went up into space and say, when they were approaching the moon and they could see all the other planets, many of them describe a very similar sensation, a feeling of real connection, understanding that everything is part of everything else, some kind of spiritual insight. And so I think these experiences just shake us out of our everyday state of complacency, basically.
Which obviously is a good thing. We can kind of shake things up a little bit and try to get a different perspective on where we are from where we've been. And because a lot of times our lives do get kind of stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kind of sit there. And again, this is not, this is not to encourage people to go out and try to create near-death experiences.
Certainly not. No.
But that's the whole point of the book, is you pick up a copy of Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. You get those perspectives, and maybe just through that, maybe living vicariously through these experiences in your book, it'll help to shake up people's lives a little bit.
Well, I very much hope so. And as I said, you know, there are different sections in the book, and some of the stories are, you know, transformations that have taken place through being with a dying person or through actually losing somebody. And some are, as I mentioned before, to do with deathbed visions, and some to do with after-death communication. And I think all of these things show us that there's something more to life than, you know, we perceive to be going on. And it's during this period that we can often access this kind of information.
My understanding through my continued research into this subject in gathering guests for this ongoing topic is that there are now schools that are teaching about death and dying and near-death experiences and even out-of-body experiences, this whole issue of transitioning, if you will, and trying to understand it. So, I mean, it's really exploded in that sense. Have you, you've experienced that as well?
It has. Part of what I do is thanatology, and I think that's what you're actually referring to. Thanatology is...
Thanatology.
Thanatology, T-H.
Oh, T-H. Okay, thanatology.
Yeah. So if you perhaps wanted to find out all about this kind of information and you wanted to go and learn how to do that kind of work, you would actually do a course, and it would be a thanatology course. And you're right. You know, there are many schools offering this kind of curriculum now, and there are, you know, people crying out for more information and to have these people on hand when necessary to help, you know, in a family situation or with an individual.
And we all have different experiences when loved ones pass, and people that we, acquaintances and friends and so forth. When my grandmother passed, for me, I was a little kid. It was very, very traumatic. But as I grew up, I've only had a few people who I've been to their funerals and experienced that sense of loss. But one gentleman, it was real interesting. He was the wife of the volunteer coordinator for the station I was working for. And when we were at the service, I did not feel any kind of sadness of any kind. It was actually, from where I was, maybe intellectually and spiritually, it was, my gosh, he's everywhere. He hasn't left. I mean, that was the feeling that I had, that he was there. I didn't feel like he had gone anywhere. Is that the sense that many of these folks have? That they really aren't going out there somewhere. They're just leaving the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the point is that many people do have experiences like you've just described. They often don't tell, you know, anyone else. And so it's a taboo subject for many people. And I think, you know, if you told that story to a room full of people, you would find many people coming up to you and saying, actually, I had a very similar experience when X died or when I lost so-and-so. And I think through talking about that kind of thing very, you know, a lot more, we can get to that place of where it's more comfortable. And like you say, wouldn't you prefer to have a conversation where you could bring in something like you just described, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, what we tend to do now, many people just ignore the bereaved person or the dying person. They just want to run away as far as they can. And yet, like you said, there is the possibility, and that's the reason why I wrote this book, to experience what you experienced. And these people aren't special people. They're just everyday people like you and I. And I had my own experiences very much like that too. So I think that as human beings, during our lives, we have moments, those are moments, mm-hmm. when we actually get it. And then we get back to our everyday life and forget all about it and whatever. And it recedes into the background. And, you know, death's a bit like having a child, I think. You forget the pain and you have another one. Or someone else dies. Of course, we still have that same kind of, you know, awful sense of loss, because as human beings, we're not going to have the presence of someone precious in our lives any longer. But when we can have those kind of moments that you just described, which I describe, you know, as much as I can in these stories, then we get a sense that, you know what, there might be something else going on here, and it might not be as bad as we imagine it to be.
the folks that you've connected with through the writing of this book, both the people that you've written about, their stories, including yourself, but even people that you've just connected with through the book itself. What about the spiritual life, the connection to the universal power, God, whatever terms we could come up with to describe that? How has that changed?
Well, I think that everybody that I have spoken to, and I include myself in that, has much stronger, I say spiritual, because I don't particularly follow any one religion, but have a lot stronger spiritual convictions, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they do get to this place of an expanded ideology of you know, this sense of being connected to maybe a higher source, to there being some kind of rhythm and meaning to life beyond you're born, you work, you get sick, you get old, you die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what people are looking for. They want that place of being able to tune in to those moments when they feel that, and they feel it to be, you know, real and genuine.
Do you see that it kind of comes in spurts as far as our society is concerned? When certain events are happening in the world, we kind of gravitate towards those things, and then when things kind of calm down, maybe like what you were saying before about those aha moments, we have them, and then we forget about them and go about our ordinary lives, and we have to wait for the next sort of crisis stage to come along? Is that kind of when these things kind of crop up?
I think they can crop up at that. I mean, we only have to look back to 9/11 to see the impact it had on people all over the world. People were going home from there and saying, I just want to be with my family.
Mm-hmm.
I realize what's really important to me. And I guess, you know, I think that sometimes perhaps the fact that there are so many near-death experiences or other phenomena now coming into public awareness is because we have lost that place of connection. You know, years ago, people were far more in tune with the natural rhythms of life. Now they're not. So it takes a great big shock. But, you know, my point is, well, wouldn't it be much nicer if we could all live that without needing a 9/11 to remind us? And I think that perhaps is why these stories, or why these people may even choose, for all we know, to have a near-death experience, is to bring the story back. And, you know, to help us raise our own consciousness about the best way to live life.
And you think that it is possible to sort of choose to have those experiences?
Maybe.
Okay.
I mean, some people, you know, Kenneth Ring really thinks that, you know, near-death experiences are returning to raise consciousness in the world. And we need that, so who knows? We just don't know. You know, we have such a mystery here.
Right.
We have all these little pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know.
Well, we'll put your piece in there and see how it works. And that's really what this program is about, to help to raise that consciousness level, that understanding, that awareness, so that we can move forward. I remember as a kid growing up, I was watching the Jetsons thinking, oh, 2001, that'll be cool. You know, we'll be in flying cars and all of that stuff, and now we're not even close to that. Well, there's still hope for it. Maybe not flying cars, but maybe we'll be flying. You know, we'll raise the consciousness enough,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of Eternal Continuum, of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. Easy for you to say. Anna Marie Hemingway is my guest, and we're talking about this process that I just say transitioning. Death and dying, those two words in particular, they're so charged with energy. I mean, people immediately, they go to a particular place. But when you hear the word transition, that doesn't have the same connotation. And so I feel as though using that word, we can talk about it a little bit more, and so forth. And yet someone said to me, well, couldn't we change the energy of those words? Wouldn't it be possible to, you know, de-energize them and maybe energize them with some positive words? I don't know. It doesn't seem that it's happened over the centuries that we've used those words. Be that as it may, it's Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, and Anna Marie Hemingway, her website is Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a few moments. If you'd like to give us a call, 564-1290 is our number, 564-1290. Go to richarddugan.com. You can both email me at richard@richarddugan, D-U-G-A-N.com. You can also link to annamariehemingway.com or practicingconsciousliveandandying.com. From my website, go to page 3 of the radio shows down to today's date and click on the link, and we'll be back. Tell me your story. I'm Richard Dugan here with Anna Marie Hemingway and my wife Amrita, and we're sitting here talking about practicing conscious living and dying. I sometimes wonder, Anna Marie, if we have a long way to go to live consciously. We're struggling with just trying to get through day to day, and you're asking us to also contemplate having conscious dying as well. But, you know, we're trying to raise the bar a little bit, you know, raise the energy a little bit and give people something else to think about and contemplate. In our final couple of moments here, I'd like to have you, if you would, maybe talk a little bit about that in terms of are you... what is it initially, though I know that you've said this, I want you to address it in the context of this question. What is it that you are hoping to achieve and accomplish through this book, which has only been out since about January?
Well, so far, I think most people have taken from the book, you know, what I hope they would, which is that they find it inspirational and it gives them some hope and courage, certainly people that may be grieving or, you know, involved somehow in the dying process, or to know that there are all sorts of phenomena that take place that give us very strong indications that death really is, as you were saying earlier, only a transitional phase into another part of eternal life. And we have many ancient scriptures that come down, you know, for thousands of years, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all sorts of religious teachings as well. And I think if we just take the kernels from there, and myths, we have resurrection myths, creation myths, that we can see that coming through into our conscious awareness, since the beginning of humanity, we've had this same message repeated in a different way, and that all the things we've been talking about today are actually only reiterating the same message. And I think that's a message people are wanting to hear right now.
Well, I couldn't have asked for a better opportunity to present this, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. Anna Marie Hemingway is my guest. Again, it's Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. There is no dead end here. It's just it's ongoing, which is kind of an irony in one sense, because when I first got into radio, every time I left, there was always something that I was leaving behind that needed to be done. It wasn't that I didn't finish, but it was like, well, and that'll be there tomorrow to take and continue on. And, well, that's life. Every day we get up and we do something that's left over from the day before, or, you know, every day you have to take care of your animals or fill up the car or whatever the case might be. It is a continuation from the day before. And life is just a small little, as they say, spark, if you will, or what have you, of our eternal existence, if we can wrap our brains around that. And I want to thank you very much for not only being here on the program, but also coming in all the way from Ojai. Appreciate that. And I hope your journey home is safe. Well, I tell you one thing, it would be a great drive, because you're driving right along the water, right along the ocean. And that's a beautiful drive. It really is. And again, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great being with you.
We encourage you to pick up a copy of Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. That is also the website, practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com. AnnaMarieHemingway.com is also the website, and it, I guess, will basically take you pretty much to the same place. You can also go to richarddugan.com, go to page 3 of our radio shows, scroll down to today's date, and click on Anna Marie's name. It'll take you straight to her website, and we certainly hope that you will take an opportunity to take a look at the information that she has available through her book and her website. And also what we have to offer on the website is a pre-recording of the, or rather I should say, an archive of this broadcast. When we're finished, we'll put it up on the website for you to listen to, share with family and friends. Next week, we are going to be talking with David Warner, and he is a born-again Christian who not only has experienced, but has consciously chosen to re-experience the out-of-body experience, if I can take liberties and I don't get fined too much for using the word experience too much. But he's going to be joining us and talking about his journey through this scientifically documented experience of his, and we will have him on the program next week to share his observations as a born-again Christian. It's certainly been interesting, as I've chatted with him, to hear him talk about his life as a Christian and why I chose him, because if you take a look at the basic fundamental teachings, I don't see anywhere in the Bible where it speaks of out-of-body experiences, although we were discussing here on the program off-air that Paul had what might be considered an out-of-body experience on the road to Damascus. So interesting to think about. Well, we'll be talking about it next week here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. Join us again next Saturday at the same time, 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, for Tell Me Your Story. Love to Lal. Have yourselves a terrific weekend, and have a safe 4th of July.